What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Megan Buisson. Megan is the current world record holder in inline speed skating and the 47-time national Canadian champion. She's a psychiatric survivor who's struggled with eating disorders and self-harm since childhood. She's been multiply diagnosed, including with a psychosis diagnosis, and today she no longer takes medication. She's the founder of BodyWise Youth Canada, working for prevention. She's the founder of BodyWise Youth Canada, working for prevention of eating disorders and self-harm. Welcome to Madness Radio, Megan Buisson.
Hello, Will. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, now that is really quite an accomplishment. You're the world record holder in inline speed skating. That's like rollerblading. Like you're the fastest rollerblader in the world. Is that right?
Yes, technically at that distance.
And what was the distance? Like a number of meters, there's a category and you're the fastest in that category. Is that how it is?
Yep. It's the world record. So it was 26.2 miles, 42 kilometers. And I did it in 77 minutes.
And you've beat the national record in Canada 47 times?
I did, yes. And inline speed skating, it's a unique sport. We race everything from a 200-meter time trial to the full marathon. So there were 9 distances at nationals every year, and I won all of them several times.
That's really extraordinary. It's great to have you on the show. And your excelling as an athlete, as a world-class athlete, is also really connected to your recovery story and a really remarkable journey that you've been on, fighting your way through multiple psychiatric diagnoses and being on multiple medications, as well as struggling with eating disorders and self-harm. And so when was it that the eating disorders and problems with self-harm really emerged? Was that in your childhood?
The short answer was I became anorexic when I was 13, which is when I started self-harming as well. The longer answer is it dated back likely before then. I grew up very much with the belief that failure was not an option and I was not good enough.
This was the culture in your family? Your family is very strong, perfectionist, and no failure kind of family?
A great, great family. But yeah, I was the youngest of 3 girls and we were all very good at school and very involved in sports. And my parents worked very, very hard to raise us well. And in some ways, they did a really great job. For me, being quite sensitive, when things were rocky at home, I dealt with it by shutting down and disappearing, quite literally, physically with anorexia, and then emotionally, I became aphasic, connected being loved to not being a bother. And so I became the perfect daughter and the teacher's pet and the coach's athlete, and dealt with it by shutting down, literally, and self-harming. When everything is out of control, you find something to control. And for me, it was being very uncomfortable in my body. And I starved myself to avoid puberty, having my body change out of control.
Was there anybody who was helping you or anybody who was supporting you when you started to go through this? Or
no, and that was a challenge. Physically, I did look differently than my mother and sister. That was an issue. There was no support in that realm. I was being molested by a coach at the time, which just made it worse. You take a kid who's really very, very anxious, very self-conscious, very low self-esteem, you put the one person in her life telling her that she's worth something and have it be a pedophile coach. And it is pretty awful. And that was my background from the time I was 14 till 21.
And so that really contributed to the anorexia, the eating problems. And you said also self-harm. What was it that you were doing?
It started the night before my grade 10 math exam. I was studying and I've always had a hard time with math and am the only one in my family with a hard time in math. My father was a physics teacher and my sister majored in math, and I was the kid who I memorized math in order to get through it and get my 90%. Yeah, night before the math exam, I dug nails into my thighs. I don't know why I did it, but it calmed me down enough that I was able to keep studying. And I studied and I got my 90s and that's really when it started, was just all of a sudden I had this tool in my toolkit for coping, dealing with overwhelming emotions. And looking back, that was the first time for me it was a really obvious, wow, I'm doing something to my body. Looking back now, I can see how I was a very anxious kid, and I was self-harming far sooner, just ripping off scabs. And I mean, it was same result, just numbing myself.
Yeah, you said aphasia. What is that? That's like just disconnecting and shutting down. And it seems like that's really related to the food and the self-harm. And so looking back on that, what was it that pushes someone over from dealing with the kinds of teenage struggles that so many of us have dealt with? What is it that pushes someone over to that point of starting to self-harm and starting to not eat? And
that's a great question. I believe that mental illness is a response to trauma, and ultimately that it's the manifestation of the body's inability to cope with an overwhelming emotional stress. And in my case, there were some very specific major traumas, sexual abuse being a big one. But there's also the cumulative effect of being very, very anxious and being in a household where there was fighting and getting the message that to be loved is to not exist and to not be a bother. I spent my childhood shutting up and shutting down, was how I've described it. But it's hard to pinpoint any one thing that causes eating disorders or self-harm. It's different for everyone, but ultimately it's an inability to cope with some overwhelming emotional load.
And Megan, what do you think would have helped you at age 13 or 14? Is there something that could have made a difference if something was changed, or what was it that would have helped you at that age, do you think?
Understanding and support. Prevention is key, and prevention starts with knowing what to look for, what to do, and how to react. And I know in my family, my mom has looked back since and gone, I really wish I had known what to do. We were dismissed by the doctors. The one time she took me in concerned, the doctors totally dismissed her. So there was that silencing coming from the external silencing, but also just for me within the family, having some support and not being told I was this miserable kid, or not being told that I was too sensitive and it's my fault, and being able to tell someone you're being sexually abused is critical. And I didn't even have that. So I had a dog. That's why I'm alive, is I attached to my dog.
Say a little bit more about that. Your connection with your dog really helped you to survive that.
Yeah, she did. It was, I look back now and my family's amazing. They really are. And there's a lot of love and a lot of support. And it's been a really great evolution for us, especially across the past couple of years. But when I look back to where we were, where I was when I was 12, 13 years old, I spent an awful lot of time on the back porch with my arm around a Siberian Husky. I had no friends in school. I was very, very isolated. I read. I grew up Catholic, and I used to say I never wanted a guardian angel because even angels are humans, and I wanted nothing to do with humans because humans lied and humans hurt people.
So you're saying about you, the Siberian Husky who was so important to you, reminds me about our Jack Russell Terrier in my family, Humbert. There was something about the love that we all had for Humbert and the connection that I had with Humbert, and Humbert was always there. And something, I think it really contributed to my survival and getting, you know, I think both of us owe something of our own successes in the world to that connection with animals in our childhood. And Megan, it sounds like your dedication to sports and athletics was really also a key part of how you took care of yourself and how you survived. Is that right?
Very much so. I used sport as an escape. And being an athlete for me was a way of channeling my body. My body became a tool. I no longer had to think about it as being a body. And I felt very much when I was strong, I couldn't be hurt. So on one side, there's this awfulness in sport, this molestation, this awful stuff going on. On the other side, it was a way to just channel myself and become quite an obsessive, driven athlete. I can look back now and I can see how my eating disorder contributed to my sport, but also my sport contributed to my eating disorder, and I can't separate the two of them.
That's so interesting, because the obsessive driven quality, it both has a positive and a negative side to it, because it allowed you to excel and become a world record holder in skating.
Emotional and mental characteristics that caused me to excel in sport were the ones that are most deeply entrenched in my battles to recover.
And when did you start to get involved with the psychiatric system? Because I know you had a very long journey with that.
My problems really started when I was in university, and the tight control that had manifested itself throughout my teenage years as being anorexic, I became bulimic. And so I had these episodes where I was out of control. And so it was just this, on the outside, really trying to kind of be that perfect student, getting my 90s, getting my 4.5 GPA, and then falling apart with now bulimia and severe self-harm.
So the bulimia, that was just like binge eating, that kind of thing, just eating a lot. And then the self-harm, was that still the cutting? Or?
Yeah, by that point I was cutting. I attempted suicide when I was 18, 23, 26. The only way I can describe it is when there's so much that you haven't said, and there's so much that's inside you. Every once in a while, the lid comes off. And for me, the lid would come off with bulimia or self-harm.
That's something that we've talked about a number of times on Madness Radio. Then you described it, you're the self-harming as a coping mechanism for overwhelming feelings. But you're also talking about suicide attempts. And it, maybe those are kind of different things in some ways. Because I think that's one of the messages that a lot of us are exploring and trying to express, is that, you know, people who are cutting or hitting their heads or burning or whatever it is that they're doing in terms of self-harm, it's really not a suicide attempt. It's really more about a way of getting relief from overwhelming feelings that the person is having.
So that's a great point. I view a lot of my sport as being a national team athlete as being a form of self-harm. And that's running until I fracture a fibula or multiple ankle sprains or just going out and hammering my body deliberately, saying to myself, I can deal with the physical pain because this way I don't have to feel the emotional stuff, and very consciously numbing the emotional, even at the cost of damaging my body. And I look back now at the physical damage I've done to my body, and that's why I do view a lot of how driven I was in sport as self-harm. But the suicidality was, yeah, just that absolute bleakness of despair and going, this is not going to get better. And I'm blessed I did have a couple people in my life who were there, and things have gotten a lot better.
And with the struggles in university, was that when you first started reaching out to psychiatrists or hospitals? Or
So it started with me being diagnosed as being depressed. I had moved away from home when I was 17, moved back when I was 18, and things were not good at home. Things were not good in my health. And that's when things really, really spiraled in terms of suicide ideation and attempts and self-harm and eating disorder. And it was just this awful, awful experience. So they put me on antidepressants and they told me that would make it better. And it didn't. But I got out of Winnipeg. I got into veterinary medicine. And I thought that leaving Winnipeg, where I grew up, was kind of running away from this abusive coach and leaving a lot of my family background and kind of going, okay, now I'm a veterinarian. And it didn't. I was raped in my third year. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. Everything I had shut down and everything I had pushed away, at that moment, it was a straw that broke the camel's back. And on the outside, I was still this, by that point, I had made a national team in inline, and I was still in vet school and just falling apart. And I was 9 months shy of graduating when I overdosed and, tried to kill myself. Mm. And that's when my family sent me in to see a psychiatrist. And I'll never forget sitting in this guy's office. And he looked at me and he said, well, now that you've dropped out of medical school, and that's exactly how he worded it, what do you intend to do with your life? Oh. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to become a world champion inline speed skater. And he looked a little startled and he said, well, that's ridiculous. That's delusional. And I said, no, it's not. And he said, yes, it is. And he diagnosed me as psychotic on the basis of my delusions of grandeur. And he put me on Risperdal.
He called you psychotic because you were telling him your intention to become a world record holder in inline skating, which you actually went on to do, and you are today. You're the world champion.
In fairness to him, I was homeless at the time. I wasn't able to hold down a job. I was trying to work, and there was so much going on mentally that I couldn't function. I'd lose my apartment. The doctors kept telling me that an eating disorder was a choice, and if I just wanted to get healthy, I could, and I could just stop it. And the harder I tried, it was impossible. And it was just such this feeling of self-hatred. Like, it's cruelty, absolute cruelty to tell someone with a mental issue, this is your fault, deal with it. And that was very much what I did. So he put me on Risperdal. And after that, every time I fought or said, this is not helping me, I was told I lacked insight, and that clearly my denial about my mental illness was further proof that I was mentally ill and needed to be drugged. So it was 7 years. I was on 13 different sedatives, antipsychotics, antidepressants. What's interesting is because I was racing with the national team, I had to be careful of anything I was taking that it wasn't a banned substance, basically. So anytime I went on a med, on a new drug, I had to call the World Anti-Doping Drug Association and make sure that it was actually not going to be performance enhancing.
So, for example, they might not let you take a benzodiazepine because that would be considered performance enhancing or breaking the rules about being a doped athlete.
Absolutely. Yeah, benzodiazepines are illegal in sports like biathlon because they can settle down if someone, yeah, there's a couple sports where they are illegal.
But you were competing at a national and world-class level, even though you were on all these different psychiatric drugs and struggling so much emotionally inside.
Yeah, and it was hell. I mean, I gained 20 pounds with Risperdal. And to have a doctor look at me and say, well, this is having no effect on your athletic career, you must not be exercising enough if you're gaining this much weight, is absolute cruelty for someone with, especially with an eating disorder. I was training 4 or 5 hours a day and I was still gaining weight. They told me that it would have no effect whatsoever on my reaction time. And that the big one was even if it does, you have to keep taking it because you'll die if you don't.
They believe that you had a mental illness and you were psychotic. And unless you took antipsychotic drugs, that the psychosis would kill you. So basically they're threatening you in a sense, with their own scientific understanding as a way of enforcing treatment compliance.
Yeah. And the more I fought, the more I was put on drugs. I was on 7 drugs simultaneously, 2 of which I later found out were beyond the recommended dose. When I was racing, it was 2004, I was racing at the World Championships. And if you can imagine skating in a concrete soup bowl going, I don't know, 35, 40 kilometers an hour or so. What is that, 25, 20 miles an hour? Fast, with no brakes. And a girl swerved in front of me. Because of the meds I had in my system, I did not have the ability to react. And I slammed into her at full force. And she went down and broke her wrist. I did a full somersault over top of her, landed on the back of my head, and fractured my skull. And that, for me, it was, you know, in a single heartbeat, a life can change forever. And I was then a psychiatric patient, but also a patient with traumatic brain injury. And that was the moment I said, I'm done. I am done with this. I'm done listening to doctors telling me that I will die if I'm on these meds, because I will die if I stay on these meds. And I called my doctors and I told them that. I had 2 doctors and they both said, this will kill you if you go off your medication. And I said, I'm already dead. And I pulled myself off everything that afternoon.
When they said this will kill you, were they referring to the abrupt withdrawal risk, or were they talking about the assumption that your mental illness was itself life-threatening?
I could see the meaning both. Certainly, given what I had in my system, I mean, we're talking like Prozac, lithium, Ativan, Effexor, like Risperdal. Like there was so much that was in my system of those 7 or 8 meds I was on at the time that an abrupt withdrawal was certainly counterindicated. But they had both also been very clear that I would be spending the rest of my life on antipsychotic medication. That was very, very much the message, to basically shut up and swallow, as one of them put it. So yeah, so I fractured my skull and I'd been decreasing my meds at that point. And then I just said enough's enough. And so I pulled myself off them all. In hindsight, I do wish there had been support. I know you've written the Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Meds. I've since read that and it's kind of like everything I never did. And I really wish I had. Withdrawal was very, very awful. And I don't remember, like, there's some fairly massive chunks of my life that are just black as a result. And
so you went off cold turkey and you just, out of just desperation and being fed up with what the doctors were telling you, and you went through a really rough withdrawal time.
There were definitely episodes of psychosis there. And beyond that, it's black. Like it's basically, my recollections are from what data has been collected in terms of kind of me having to temporarily go back on meds in order to taper them off because I was psychotic, and just my coach telling me that going through that experience caused him to lose all of his hair. And yeah, it was really rough. I think from being on the meds, the more I research now, there have been vestibular damage. Like there are definitely some issues that linger.
In terms of brain injury, do you think?
In terms of brain injury.
From the medications.
I look back at being on medication and there is an absolute fury within me when I look at dealing now with a traumatic brain injury and the fractured skull. And when I look at being told you've got post-concussion syndrome and wondering how much of this was iatrogenic, how much of what I now struggle with every day to the point of being labeled permanently disabled is from the medication, and not just one medication, but the polypharmacy, the let's just give you these nine drugs and you're still speaking and you're still walking, and you're still a pain in the ass. So we're going to drug you more. And just kind of that constant drugging. Yeah. I look at it. How can that not have an effect? It is certainly affected in terms of since being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, it has absolutely affected how I relate to doctors now.
It sounds like the breaking point for you was being told that these medications, these antipsychotics and everything else you were taking weren't going to affect your athletic performance, but then knowing that when you had that collision, it was because your response time was impaired and you just confronted that disconnect and you decided you were going to go with your own experience. Is that what happened?
I was living in an absolute fog. And I look back now and I'm like, how? How can someone expect someone to function when they're that drugged? The only biochemical imbalance in my brain was being caused by the meds they put me on. Like, how am I supposed to go through medical school when I have to fight to get up in the morning? How am I supposed to recover from an eating disorder when I'm gaining 20 pounds because they've put me on a drug that's cardiotoxic and is going to kill me 20 years before my peers? How am I supposed to be an athlete and do something I love when the drugs I'm told are going to save my life are destroying my life and killing me? The pathetic nadir for me was the absolute and utter arrogance of the doctors I was working with. There was absolutely no question that I had a mental illness. And it was, I just wanted to say, like, stop asking what's wrong with me and ask me what did I go through. And I pulled myself off the meds. I wouldn't recommend doing it as I did, obviously. That was awful. I really wish I had the support I had now then. When I look back at my life, given a choice between staying on the medication or going off, I would make the same decision again in a heartbeat. I've been very clear with my psychiatrist now that I will not go back on antipsychotic medication or psychiatric medication. But I also view it as a choice and a responsibility. Being on psychiatric medication for me was like being a bird in a cage with no knowledge of the bars. I didn't know how drugged I was until I got off the medication. And I looked at it and I went, how are you supposed to recover when everything they're giving you is killing you? How are you supposed to be normal when the very pills you're taking render you abnormal? How are you supposed to function when you fight to get out of bed? And there was no, regardless of whatever causal factors precipitate starting a psychiatric medication, there's no denying that the underlying issues lead to this vicious cycle of physical and emotional suffering. Well, just from whatever someone goes through. I mean, if someone is struggling, there's already the cycle of emotional and physical suffering causing feelings of inadequacy, hopelessness, and despair. But the underlying issues that lead to someone being diagnosed with depression or God knows what, regardless of what those underlying issues are, the underlying issues that precipitate, magnify, and maintain crises are not solved with drugs. Rather than addressing complex psychosocial origins, psychiatric medication only serves to flatten an emotional response. That's not a cure. It is a chemical lobotomy. And I made a choice and I said no.
And then when you did get off of the medications and you went through this horrendous withdrawal period, you're also recovering from the fractured skull and the brain injury. How did you recover from all that? How did you make it back to where you are today?
That's where I say coming off medication was a choice as much as a responsibility. I did three things. The first was I had support by that point. I had a coach, I had a physiotherapist, and I now have a psychiatrist. Those three men fought for me, and they have kept me alive. I had support who believed in me, even when I didn't believe in myself. The second thing I did was get educated. And it was with an eating disorder saying, if something's going to kill me, I'm going to learn what it is. And just really digging into the underlying issues and going, if I'm going to reject this belief that there's something biochemically wrong in my brain, I need to look at my trauma. And how do I do that? And then building my own support network.
How did you approach dealing with trauma? Because I think that's a situation that a lot of people find themselves in, that they wake up to the fact that focusing on mental illness misses their personal history and that there are things that happened to them that maybe they haven't wanted to look at or hasn't been the right time or they haven't had the support or it's been too overwhelming or too traumatic or they've used denial as a coping mechanism to survive and forgotten and suppressed it. And how did you approach engaging with your own trauma history once you realized that the medications weren't the answer for you?
It started for me with support. I was very fortunate to, because of my trauma, I wound up in the office of a psychiatrist who handed me talking back to Prozac as opposed to listening to Prozac. and he really...
That's a book by Peter Breggin.
Yeah, Peter Breggin. It was great.
A psychiatrist gave you that. You found some people in the system who actually validated your concerns and point of view.
One.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. Our guest today is Megan Buisson. Megan is the current world record holder in inline speed skating and the 47-time national Canadian champion. She's a psychiatric survivor who struggled with eating disorders and self-harm since childhood. She's been multiply diagnosed, including with psychosis. Today, she no longer takes medication and is the founder of BodyWise Youth Canada, working for prevention of eating disorders and self-harm. That's often all it takes. So many people's stories, it turns on just making one connection with one person at the right time.
And that for me really, really made the difference, because I'd grown up being told that how could I think that I was stupid and absolutely have to do this, and kind of all the messages I had about myself and just that whole perception that I was this really awful, difficult psychiatric patient. I was getting kicked out of treatment because I was non-compliant and it was like having someone channel that little inner voice that was kind of going, good for you, and finding support, and then going a step beyond and finishing my degree and really looking at psych drugs with my degree and really, yeah, just saying I can be totally unapologetic about saying what's true. When I think about dealing with trauma, that's why I say in some ways being on the medication was easier, because it numbed everything. And to deal with my life now, it's like everything is in hypercolor. And it's big, it's emotion, it's triggers, it's dealing with things like post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's a lot harder. But the flip side is, in some ways it's not, because I can feel, I can hope, I am alive. I believe in the judicious use of medication. I'd certainly never tell someone, absolutely do not take meds. It's do what's right for you. And if it helps you, then keep doing it. As long as it's not illegal or moral or hurting anyone else, then who cares? If it works, use it, is my personal opinion. But it's, for me, it was to deal with my trauma. It was finding support, and it was getting educated to say, I will make evidence-based decisions and I will live with those consequences. I fractured my skull in 2004, was in treatment, came out in 2006 and broke the world record. And when I broke the world record, I sent a postcard to the psychiatrist who had diagnosed me as crazy.
Wait a second. You broke the world record after you had this brain injury, fractured your skull, and you got off all your psychiatric drugs cold turkey. Then you went on to set the world record in inline speed skating.
I did, yes. And skating for me was my way of saying, you know what, I am me. This is who I am. This is what I love. And that moment, breaking the world record, was such a pinnacle, because there had been so much pressure not to skate and to just accept being a psychiatric patient and to say no and to break the record was truly a highlight. But the second highlight was going back to Saskatoon, which is a city where I'd originally been diagnosed, and actually running into the psychiatrist who had originally told me that my goals of becoming a world champion in inline speed skating were delusional, and not just delusional, but actually downright psychotic. And I had sent him a letter as well. And in it, I said, the definition of insanity is defined far too often by individuals with no proof they are sane. It's such a challenge to be labeled a non-compliant patient, because there's still trauma and there's still need and there's still a need for support and there's still unresolved issues. And to have to fight against the very system, which is supposedly in place to help you, then creates a void, because then what do you do? And I was very, very lucky. I met another psychiatrist in the city I now live in who didn't just support my decision not to be medicated, but really validated it and has really validated who I am. And it really has made the big difference in terms of having support when I need it and me being able to function. And
even though you had broken the world record in skating, you still went through a long recovery process.
Yeah, recovery is a verb, not a noun. It's a journey to walk every day, and I still struggle. In making the decision not to be on medicine, and it's again, it's an individual choice. The path I've taken, someone else may have taken a different decision, and that's great for them. It's every minute of every day I deal with it.
What are some of the things that you deal with?
There's still eating disorder, self-harm, a lot of trauma triggers, post-traumatic stress disorder. I was jumped at night. I was raped. It makes sleep difficult. it makes dating difficult. When I do date, I tend to date guys who aren't great for me. But that's part of the learning process is being able to say, you know, I deserve to be happy and healthy and be treated with respect, including my own.
And even though you've retired from competitive sports, you still are the world record holder.
Yeah, I broke the world record by 10 minutes.
10 minutes. That's going to take a while for people to catch up with you.
It will, yes. That's a good point to raise because I retired from skating. And it was this void because I'd spent 10 years running around the world to run away from myself. But no matter where I went, I was always there and I could never get away from myself. And so when I stopped skating, all this trauma, like the sexual abuse I'd never dealt with, the eating disorder, like there was so much I hadn't dealt with that all of a sudden was in my face. And it wasn't just in my face. I had so many injuries from skating. I had both my ankles reconstructed. So the first 22 months off skates, I was non-weight bearing in a cast. And so I went from being kind of really active to not being able to move and depressed and having no friends and having very few internal supports because I had always just skated.
So when you made a commitment to recovery, you also stepped back from some of the parts of your sports and your athleticism that also had a self-harm aspect to them.
Absolutely. I broke the world record and I've stood on 16 international podiums, I think. I had a lot of really great results as an athlete, but the one thing I never did in all my years of skating was skate a season healthy. And when I retired from skating, I was so injured and so broken from just pounding my body that I really sat with that. And I mean, it's awful to be in your 30s and to wonder if you're going to be able to walk, to worry if you're going to be able to run. My body, kind of all the stress and trauma I'd never dealt with while skating, the first 2 years after I stopped skating, my body shut down. Like I had crazy injuries and stuff I can look back now and kind of go, wow, there's a really strong trauma link there. But recovery meant dealing with the physical stuff. It meant dealing with the emotional stuff. It meant saying, okay, if I'm going to deal with this, how do I choose to deal with it and not just run away? And when I stopped skating and realized that running away was not enough to deal with underlying trauma and that I could say, yeah, I'm going to live a life off medication, but there has to be something else there. And it meant consciously building a support network. It meant finding a doctor who supported me. It's meant engaging things like meditation and yoga and really actively, unapologetically finding things that work for me. And part of it has been actually going back to sport. And I'm now training with a triathlon group and I love it because I love it for many reasons, but one of them for me is also it's really great being an athlete and being healthy and realizing that those two things do not have to be separate. It's possible to be an athlete at a very high level and be healthy and be happy and be dealing with trauma.
And tell us about your work with BodyWise, the organization that you founded in Canada that works to prevent eating disorders and self-harm among youth.
BodyWise Youth Canada is the only charity in Canada focused on preventing eating disorders and self-harm in youth. It was founded literally sitting around a kitchen table at a treatment facility. One girl had just died in treatment. And I looked at the other girls and said, well, what would have kept you from being here? And we started brainstorming that night. And when I came out, I started researching and started speaking. And it was me literally driving across Western Canada in a Toyota Tercel, homeless, talking to parents about eating disorder and self-harm prevention.
And what are some of the things that you educate families around in terms of prevention and noticing the signs and how to respond to people who are in trouble?
BodyWise, just two things. Firstly, we talk to adults. So we are educating parents, teachers, coaches of early warning signs and prevention. So what to say, what not to say, what to look for, what to do at the early stages, where to get help. It can be anything from the mom who calls me and goes, I don't know where to send my kid. I don't know what to do. Early warning signs. So one of the examples we have is for parents, when to worry if a child is an athlete, how to distinguish between a child who's very focused on their sport versus a child who is engaging in exercise as a means of purging. What are the red flag questions? What to look for? For example, is the sport cutting into family time? Is the child constantly exercising, even when they're injured, even when they're sick, even when there's Christmas, for example? How do they address that? What's the underlying emotional issue going on? So just getting families to actually look a little bit deeper at the behaviors. We couple that with youth education. And when I started BodyWise, the comment I got was, oh, that's wonderful. You're going to talk to kids about eating disorders. And my standard response was no, because it's not the 10-year-old's responsibility not to be bulimic. We're in the schools teaching coping skills to kids. So looking at eating disorders and self-harm as an unconscious response to overwhelming emotional stress, what are alternate coping skills? So mindfulness, meditation, reaching out, support. That's a big one with the kids. The kids always want to know, well, what do? I'm worried about my friend. So I'll role play with them. Let's talk about how you can approach your friend. Let's talk about how you can talk to someone about help. And then it's really educating the adults. And I mean, ultimately let's deal with emotional issues in youth by providing support and not pathologizing and saying, yeah, let's support and not just drug you.
And it sounds like your approach to these issues is quite different than the more mainstream look, just get people into treatment, trust your psychiatrist, do what the doctor says, medications are the answer. These are signs of an underlying mental illness, not necessarily real emotional issues like trauma or abuse that need to be addressed more through support and through talking about them and getting people to connect.
My personal opinion is be chary about a psychiatric diagnosis. If a label helps, that's great. But if it's being given simply as a label to avoid looking into the deeper underlying issues, yeah, I do take exception to that. The one thing I found in my own recovery, which has been supported by research, Barker and Buchanan Barker just came out this past year with a study finding that extra therapeutic factors such as social support have an even greater impact on outcome than intratherapeutic ones. That the belief in support is so great, the quality of the service provider isn't as important as the perception of the quality by the service user. In short, if a patient likes and trusts and feels supported by his or her psychiatrist, that has far greater bearing than on anything said psychiatrist does. It's finding that figure that works and finding the doing whatever works. I suppose my approach is harm reduction and minimization, which is, you know, if as long as it's not illegal, immoral, or hurting anyone and it works, do it. I'll give a personal example is if I'm having really awful issues with PTSD and I'm dealing with that in therapy, but if I go 3-4 nights and I'm not sleeping and I'm terrified that there's someone in my apartment, I will trigger a psychotic state. Like I simply cannot function after 3 nights of sleep. No one can, especially me. So I will keep a prescription for that reason. And if I kind of go 3 or 4 nights and I can't do yoga and I can't meditate myself down and I'm still triggering, I'll knock myself out to sleep. I don't like doing it, but for me, that's one of those harm reductions. It's what do I need to do in the moment when I've exhausted everything else? And so that's where I will use medication.
And I think that's a really wise approach, because once we get absolutist about anything, we just close ourselves off from useful tools. And if that situation of sleep deprivation, the dangers of sleep deprivation are going to be greater.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Yeah, absolutely. And that's really where BodyWise shines, is we are not affiliated with any sector. Our job is simply to give parents and families and teachers the resources they need to access the appropriate help and let it be an educated, informed decision.
And so your work with BodyWise in Canada, how successful has it been? How effective have you been in reaching people?
It's been unreal. We became a national charity in February. We were picked up as a feature charity and we're on TV 150 times in 4 months. A local philanthropist caught wind of us and has become quite a supporter of BodyWise. So to date, we've reached over 5,000 families and youth within the Calgary area. And BodyWise, I mean, our main role is to simply help people get the answers they need to understand mental conditions of emotional distress, like eating disorders and self-harm, and to know where to go to get help. So it's very much that education component. Let's help people understand something. And then also with this knowledge, now what? Where do I go? How do I advocate for myself, for my child, to get and be healthy?
Well, congratulations on all your successes with that. And Megan, how would people get in touch with you, and how would they find out more about your work and your experience and find out more about BodyWise?
Well, to get wise about BodyWise, you can visit us at GetWise. That's www.getwise, GETWHYS.ca.
Megan Buisson, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Megan Buisson. She's the current world record holder in inline speed skating and has been the national champion in Canada 47 times. She's a psychiatric survivor who struggled with eating disorders and self-harm since childhood. She's been multiply diagnosed, including with psychosis, and she no longer takes medication. She's the founder of Bodywise Youth Canada, which works for the prevention of eating disorders and self-harm. She's the founder of Bodywise Youth Canada, which works for the prevention of eating disorders and self-harm. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.